This is question, you know me, is the amazing question. Would you believe it or not, can you imagine my dream? Whenever I'm in Vegas, I enjoy picking up girls with Mr. Media.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to book editor, turned agent, turned internet mogul, turned, well, I'm not really sure. I kind of lost track of him for a few years. And then turned writer, J.E. Fishman. His first novel, Primacy. Stick around. I'm not only the president of the Joel Fishman Fan Club, I'm a former client. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. You know, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Stop by and check it out. There are more than 900 archived celebrity and pop culture interviews for your listening pleasure. The show is brought to you today by Audible. Audible is offering Mr. Media listeners a free audiobook download and a 14-day trial offer to give you a chance to check out their very cool service. I love listening to books on tape. If you've never tried it before, actors or sometimes the authors themselves read to you. It's great for the commute, the beach, or even unwinding before bed. You can choose a free audiobook from Audible's enormous library of best-selling titles, including The Help by Catherine Stockett, A Stolen Life by J.C. Dugard, and Bossy Pants by Tina Fey. Here's an excerpt from Bossy Pants, read by the author, Tina Fey.
Because I am nothing if not an amazing businesswoman, I researched what kind of content makes for best-selling books. It turns out the answer is one-night stands, drug addictions, and recipes. Here, we are out of luck. But I can offer you lurid tales of anxiety and cowardice. Why is this audiobook called Bossy Pants? One, because the name Two and a Half Men was already taken. And two, because ever since I became an executive producer of 30 Rock, people have asked me, is it hard for you being the boss? And is it uncomfortable for you to be the person in charge? You know, in that same way they say, gosh, Mr. Trump, is it awkward for you to be the boss of all these people? I can't answer for Mr. Trump, but in my case, it is not.
You can also download The Profiler, written by famed criminal profiler Pat Brown and yours truly, which Pat will read to you personally. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/radio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/radio for your free audiobook. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience that can type, but they can't write worth a damn, in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. I wasn't really sure about the right way to introduce today's guest, Joel Fishman. Ultimately, I opted to be straightforward, so here it is. I owe a good deal of my success as a published author to Joel Fishman. As my literary agent back in the 90s, he had a faith in me that was unflagging, and he was the kind of pit bull in negotiations that you were always glad was on your side, not theirs. My three biggest book deals and top three best-selling titles to date were all on his watch. I always imagined we'd grow old in the business together. So it was a tough day in St. Petersburg when Joel sold his agency and decided to try his hand at other things. Yeah, we drifted apart, and it took some time for me to develop another lasting agency relationship. And during that time, Joel tried his hand at several other things, including becoming a father. Imagine my surprise a few weeks back when my former agent showed up in the email asking to come on Mr. Media to talk about his first novel, Primacy. I asked to read it first, but that was just a formality. No way I say no to this guy. Primacy is really a fine first effort. The action is fast and furious, and its stars are both female, Leanne, the animal researcher, and Bee, the talking bonobo. Yes, Rise of the Planet of the Apes fans, this monkey talks, and it's purely a coincidence of timing that Primacy followed on the heels of a great ape flick. I highly recommend you read Primacy and pay attention to my good old friend, Joel Fishman. Joel, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you, Bob, and thanks for the flattering introduction.
You know, I appreciate the check that you sent. Joel, a book about a talking ape, the stars are both female. Fishman, I feel like I hardly know you at all.
Well, let me tell you, it was not, there were times when I questioned the wisdom of having chosen to have a female protagonist, not because from a commercial perspective it's a bad decision. You know, many people know that the majority of readers are women, although perhaps not the majority of thriller readers, but because it's tough to write about the opposite sex. And one of the things that I found was that a lot of the things that I'd written early on, the earlier versions of this character, were very self-conscious about her being a female. Unfortunately, I had the wisdom to cut most of that stuff out before it saw the light of day. But it was a challenge.
Do you write something like this thinking that this would help to sell it as a movie? I mean, I know from experience that you can be a little calculating about, you know, that kind of stuff, knowing, you know, what the value of different things is. Or did it just work to telling the story that she be that this be a woman?
I think, you know, I sort of wear two hats, and the writer hat goes where the story takes me. The sort of publisher hat is more calculating. And as a publisher, I had a couple of different novels that I had to choose from in terms of what I should bring out to the public first, sort of in a big way, you know, to bring into bookstores. And this one, because it had what we would call an off-the-book-page hook, meaning that there's something beyond reviews that might interest people, in this case the subject of animal research and animal rights, it had that element to it. So that was strongly in its favor. And I like the fact that it had a female protagonist, because thriller readers are women, and there are probably more male protagonists in thrillers than there are female protagonists. Although you know, there are quite a few of both. But this story it sort of is a feminine story, because I think at heart it's a story about love and connection, and those are feminine values. And it works better with a female protagonist, in my opinion.
I think I got about a third to a half of the way through the book, and I was immediately casting the movie. I mean, you know, I was thinking start off with an Anne Hathaway who's working in the lab coat, and you don't really see her, and, you know, she's kind of mousy, and then, you know, at a certain point in the story, the lab coat is off, she's, you know, kicking this guy in the nuts on the subway, and suddenly you realize that you know, our little mousy librarian is just going to kick the crap out of everyone she encounters, and it becomes a very different story. And you know, it's cool that way. It's very cool.
Yeah, well, I think what happens you know, is when you give a character a moral dilemma, and a moral dilemma you know, is a choice or a series of choices that is truly revealing of characters. Of character, and a lot of you know, people, when they think of character, they're really thinking of characterization. You know, the person's in a wheelchair, the person has a limp, the person is tall or short, or you know, a former, you know, army medic or whatever. Those are all elements of characterization. But really, where character comes out is when there's a difficult decision to be made. Am I going to go quietly into this good night, or am I going to fight my way out of this thing? And that's where you really get the depth of character. I'm glad to hear you mention the movie thing. We have not sold movie rights to this point, but I've had a lot of people tell me that they found the writing was cinematic.
Oh, absolutely.
Which I definitely took as a compliment.
Was I the only one who was surprised that, and I don't mean to infer anything, but was I the only one who was surprised that for your first novel that, you know, you're writing a female character? I was a little surprised by that.
Oh, it's fine. I haven't had anybody comment specifically about that. I mean, I've had people ask me about the challenges of writing a female character as a male, but I haven't had anybody express, you know, shock that Fishman has chosen to write about women.
I was a little surprised.
You see my macho side, Bob, as a negotiator. You see, I keep that well hidden most of the time.
Okay. Well, maybe that's it. Maybe it's that side of, you know, that kind of threw me off. And then tell me about this part of it. Talking monkey. I mean, that's like, you know, is that, Joel Fishman, J.E. Fishman, as you are now, came up with a talking monkey story? I mean, I was, you know, that was the other thing that kind of threw me off.
Well, that was really the genesis of the story. I was ever since I've decided to write fiction, you know, in one's downtime, ideas float into your head, and then you sort of test them over time a little bit and think, is there a real story here, or can I see something unfold from this premise, or is it going into a dead end? And I was driving around the car one day, and for some reason I was thinking about all these efforts that researchers and so on make, fairly benign researchers, with regard to trying to get animals to speak. And there have been some famous apes that have spoken, parrots and other things that have spoken in one form or another, you know, sign language or pictograms or whatnot. And I thought, wouldn't it be ironic if an ape finally did sort of cross that barrier naturally, and of all places, it found itself in an animal testing lab, in a place that essentially was hostile to its very being. And how would people react to that? I decided that it would be a pretty big threat to entrenched interests. That's a big industry, and people have their way of, you know, there are many people who get a degree of their human self-esteem from the idea that we're better than all these other species. And so, you know, if Leanne, the researcher who discovers this ape, just decides to do nothing and just to accept that this poor thing is trapped in an animal testing laboratory run by people who are not looking out for its interests, then, of course, there's no story. But if she decides to, if her character goes in a way where she is, you know, willing to resist, you know, the forces that are arrayed against this chimp, then you've got the beginning of a novel, and in this case, the beginning of a thriller.
And am I saying it right, Bonobo, or?
Bonobo.
Bonobo, okay.
Yeah, you had it right.
All right, and folks, I got to tell you that if you watch the original Superman movie with Christopher Reeve and you believe that a man could fly, you will read this story and you will believe that a monkey can talk. What's the total coincidence, right, that the Rise of the Planet of the Apes came out just a short time before this book?
Yes, total coincidence. I started this book about 3 years ago. It's been on and off effort for about 3 years, and I didn't have any idea that the Planet of the Apes, maybe I'm out of the loop, but I had no idea about the Planet of the Apes movie until about 2 months ago, when my publicist mentioned that this movie was about to come out. I recently, you know, ran out to see the movie because I figured people will ask me about it. And it's a pretty good movie. It's quite different. I think, you know, if you do a sort of a half sentence description, it might sound like it's similar. And the talking ape thing obviously is an inevitable comparison. But it's quite a different story. And one of the differences I really note, in fact, is this difference between, I think, the Planet of the Apes, the most recent one, is a very male-oriented story. It's a male chimp, and the chimp's first act is really an act of resistance. And the chimp's first word in Planet of the Apes is no.
Right.
In Primacy, the chimp's first word is Ndeko, which is Lingala for brother. And the perspective of Primacy is really a perspective of love.
It was, I think it was incredibly good fortune that there was an Apes movie not being made, but that it turned out and it was a good movie, because I think it really whetted people's appetite for that type of thing. So I think if people find your book or hear about your book, if they were positively impacted by, you know, seeing that Rise of the Planet of the Apes, this is a nice fit. It's not the same story, but it does fit into that. I don't want to call it a genre, but there's a connection that you could make there,
yeah,
if you liked one.
Oh, absolutely. The big thing they have in common besides a talking ape is I think they're both an exploration of humans' relationship with animals on some level, and humans' place in the universe, or at least place in the world. There's no question that it's fortuitous that movie not only happened when it has, but that it's been a success and it's been a big hit, and I certainly hope if somebody walks into the book's going to be on tables at the Hudson News chain and airport stores, for example, and if somebody sees that you know, book jacket with the title and the premise and the ape image on it, you know, that if they feel like they didn't get enough from Planet of the Apes, that, you know, I hope they'll explore this book and you'll get a greater depth of understanding of some of these issues.
The only thing I was thinking was that it would have been nice if folks can see the cover here. We've already flashed it at the beginning of the show. If it had a little word balloon and B was actually saying primacy, you know, a little cartoon kind of, that would give.
That might be good for the parody version.
and how lucky were you that the movie didn't suck? Because that would have hurt. Actually, I think could be like,
I
mean, oh God.
Right. Well, you know, it's way too early in the process of the publication of this book to be counting my chickens, but there's no question that it's a bit of luck that the movie was pretty good and as successful as it's been.
Now I got to ask you this: the story has the potential to be very politically charged on one side or another. So I was a little surprised, and I'm not giving away the ending of the book, but an author's note at the end where you say the author is neither a scientist nor an animal rights activist. Why? I mean, I thought that was almost kind of a cop-out on your part not to. We've read this entire book, and I don't want to give away anything, but yeah, I mean, it takes place. It starts in an animal testing facility. It's just gotten way out of hand, and you've made this great case, but then it sort of seemed like a cop out. We just kind of, you know, was it CYA or was it something else there?
Well, I hope it wasn't CYA. Maybe it was, to the extent that I don't expect I don't wish anybody to portray me as an expert on these issues. I think that, you know, with regard to the role of a novelist, Milan Kundera had a good line. Milan Kundera, the famous novelist, said that it's not the novelist's job to provide the answers. It's the novelist's job to pose the right questions. And I think that, you know, on some level, people with an agenda on this issue, on one side or the other, none of them probably would be 100% happy with me. The animal rights guys in this novel are, a little bit... skewed in a certain direction, shall we say. I don't want to also give too much of the plot away, but, I think that the protagonist's sympathy is not 100% with the animal rights people, even though her actions are concordant with the values of, among other things, the primacy of the individual, which I think is certainly a rights issue. And the scientists, I think there probably is an argument that, you know, for some level of research on animals that is justifiable. But I personally do think, from the research I did for the book, that things are skewed way too much against the animals, and there's not enough of an acknowledgement that, as the philosopher Peter Singer would say, that these animals have interests and they have the capacity to suffer. So in some sense, I started out, being sort of neutral, and I sort of wrote my way a little bit, more toward the animal rights argument than the other way, but largely because that's where the character took me. Mm-hmm. Anybody to think I had really written this book because I was staking out a political position. At the end of the day, it's entertainment.
Well, you follow that line with information about PETA and another group, and I thought that was probably sufficient. But I'm just telling you, I was a little disappointed that I got through this whole, really cool story, really flowing action, and it with a point of view. And the point of view is that neither side is necessarily right in this, which is fine. But then to say, it's not I just thought, if you go to a second edition, I take that line out, I guess is what I'm saying, Joel.
All right, well, maybe. Yeah. I'll take it under advisement.
You do that. You do that. It's about time you started listening to me instead of vice versa. let's take a quick break. This is Bob Adelman, and you're listening to and hopefully watching the Mr. Media interview with novelist Joel Fishman, author of Primacy. And we'll be right back.
You boys and girls won't object to Grove's emulsified nose drops. There's nothing unpleasant about them. They don't run out of your nose and make you messy. They don't run down the back of your throat and make you sickish. What's more, they don't burn or sting the inside of your nose. They quickly check a head cold and yet do it in a nice way. These nose drops are something brand new and a big improvement on old-fashioned oil drops. Mother is interested in getting results when you have a cold in the head, and she'll get results much faster with Groves Emulsified Nose Drops. In every section of the country, Groves Emulsified Nose Drops are selling at an amazing rate. That's because they are better in every way. Tell Mother to procure a bottle at the corner drugstore. Groves Emulsified Nose Drops will surprise you with the way they look and act. These nose drops are white and creamy. They don't look, taste, or smell like medicine, yet they are highly effective. That's because they are medically superior, because they stay up in the nose. Any child can understand that nose drops that stay up in the nose will do more good than nose drops that run right out. Impress this fact upon Mother, and she will undoubtedly let you try these new type nose drops when you have a head cold or stuffed head. All drugstores sell Groves Emulsified Nose Drops, and they're really more economical than the old-fashioned kind because you get more for your money and because you can use less. Ask Mother to get a bottle today.
Hey, folks. You can hear Mr. Media while on the go now with Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is a free news and talk mobile app available for your smartphone, whether you use an iPhone, iPod Touch, Android, BlackBerry Curve, or Palm Pre. And when you download Stitcher to hear Mr. Media today, you have a chance to win some real money. Downloading is quick and easy. Just find Stitcher in your smartphone's app store. Download it. It's free. Takes seconds. Then, during registration, hit the promo code box and enter Mr. Media, that's MR Media, to get automatically entered to win $100. The latest episode of Mr. Media will be waiting for you in Stitcher's favorites right on your phone. You'll get access to lots of other amazing shows, too. Always available to you on demand, no syncing. Some of my favorites include WTF with Mark Maron, Plus One Per Diem with Kevin Smith, and The Nerdist with Chris Hardwick. It's all free and all instant to you on Stitcher Smart Radio. And don't forget to win the money. Enter promo code Mr. Media, MR Media, when you register. And thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Guy Kawasaki. You're listening to Mr. Media, you poor slob.
This is Bob Andelman, and you're listening to and hopefully watching the Mr. Media interview with novelist Joel Fishman, author of Primacy. So, Joel, you know, you've done all these other roles. You've been an editor. You've been an agent. Tell us about the craft for you of becoming a writer full-time. You know, when did you start writing fiction, and why fiction? Why not do, you know, nonfiction or something else?
I started writing fiction a long time ago, probably when I was 10 or 12 years old. Mm-hmm. Certainly in high school I was writing some fiction, and I've always wanted to be a novelist, but I somehow never got around to it. And, you know, it was the old thing of go get a paying job and you know, don't risk everything on, you know, on this and so on and so forth. And, you know, I had some business success recently, and we moved and we sold the business, and I thought, I'm not getting any younger, and this ambition to write, you know, still nags at me after all these years. So I finally decided to commit myself to it full time. And I think you do have to look at it as a job. And I sit at my desk every day and write when I'm not, you know, busy trying to publicize, you know, the things I've already created, that is. The reason, you know, fiction versus nonfiction, you know, to some degree, I like to joke that nonfiction deals with small truths and fiction deals with big truths. But what's that?
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it really is sort of the bigger human story, for some reason, can be portrayed better, you know, in fiction. In nonfiction, people tend to, you know, bog down on the details. It's sort of like, you know, going out into the weeds, and there's virtue in that for the proper story told by the proper person. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, the bigger stories, the stories that reach into the human heart, are really you know, great fictional stories. And for me, that's what I've always felt called to do. I never considered myself, I had worked as a journalist many years ago, very briefly, but I never, you know, being a good journalist is, although some journalists certainly are very good writers, is more about having a nose for news and really loving all those little details and loving getting that little story. And for me, what I love is creating something out of whole cloth and convincing people to buy into that story enough to continue with it and hopefully to sit down afterwards for a few minutes and reflect on it and be moved by it and just be moved to greater thoughtfulness by it. So that's what turns me on.
That's it? I mean, if I asked Pam, would she tell me that maybe there were some other things that turn you on, or maybe we should skip past that?
Yes, is that the only thing that turns me on? Yeah. But I've actually turned on, among other things, by great food, but I don't write about food.
Oh, okay, not yet anyway. You probably didn't write about apes 3 years ago.
True enough.
So I wanted to ask you about where you write, and for the audience that's listening to this on podcast and not video, I'm assuming that the room we're seeing you in is your office.
Yeah, that's correct. This is where I write. I have on the bookshelf behind me some books that I've worked on over the years as editor or agent. I have, you can't really see, but the walls are covered by book jackets, including yours, Bob. In fact, there's one up here out of sight, The Profit Zone by Adrian Slotsky. With Bob Andelman.
Yeah, let's see if I can point. Folks, if you look right about where my finger is, that's Built from Scratch, the book I did with the Home Depot guys.
There you go.
Very nice.
So, you know, I keep these things remind me, you know, writing is a lonely craft. You know, it's mostly just you and that keyboard. And it's nice to be able to spin around once in a while and be reminded of the prior success, albeit wearing different hats. But I have an office about 5 miles from my house. It's important to me to make that transitional drive. I've tried working from home, and it's not nearly as productive for me as being able to just get in the car, go to a different place, and I sit in this little office and crank it out.
It's funny, after, let's just say more than 20 years of writing, I'm actually thinking that at some point it might be fun to have an office to go to. I've always done it at home. And strangely, I'm thinking when my daughter's out of high school, that might be the time to get an office. And I've probably got it backwards, but, you know, what are you going to do? What are you going
to
do?
I think it's probably a better economic decision to stay at home. Why pay the extra rent? But
yeah,
you have to do what works for you.
I don't know. Change the scenery might be nice. Maybe I'll just come up and rent your home office while you go off to the office, and I'll work at your place.
It'll be a long commute for you.
Well, yeah, that's probably true. Have you developed any rituals around writing? Do you have to have a certain, you know, cup of coffee, or are you a Mountain Dew fiend? Or do you, you know, you got to have your crumpets, or, you know, what do you do in the morning?
No, I mean, I'm in some sense ashamed to say that I don't have. You hear so much about writers who have a routine, and where, you know, they write at a certain hour, or they write, they have to be in a certain place. I never had any of those things. In fact, I don't even necessarily write at the same time of day. The one thing I try to do is once I've started to write, I try to be committed to it either for a period of time, usually 3 or 4 hours steady, and or a number of words, number of pages. I mean, the point being simply to sort of stay put and be productive for a chunk of time. But I have not felt up to this point, and maybe I would have produced more if I had. But I haven't felt that fitted into a rigid framework. Maybe I should do that, because at this point I really now with this novel out, there are a lot of distractions around publicizing the novels, and I find the past couple of months I haven't had a lot of time to write, and probably I need to carve out more time, because I've got a ton of ideas and things that I'm looking to pursue.
I'm just kind of curious, and I guess I'm asking this from my own experience, but has becoming the father of a young lady, you've got a 10-year-old daughter, has that impacted your writing in terms of what you will write and what you won't write?
I don't think, not too much. The great impact is my daughter is a big reader, and she writes all the time, a lot more than I ever did when I was 10 years old. And she's one of my greatest fans, and it's really cute, and it's really encouraging to see, you know, how much she just admires the whole concept of somebody, creating stories and moving people with stories. I think one has to be careful not to, get sort of distracted by at least in my opinion, thinking about your writing for one person or writing in the context that you don't want a person to read a certain thing, so you won't write about it. I think the sort of, to my mind, like the sort of famous thing would be to, oh, I don't want my mother-in-law to read this sex scene, you know. And I think you really have to distance yourself, from that, because, you know, yeah, I have a daughter and I'll always have a daughter, but she won't always be 10. And I think at the end of the day, if there are things that are not, she's not ready to read, and she understands that. And but when she's the appropriate age, I want her to look at it and say, yeah, Dad didn't pull any punches.
Well, the reason I ask is that the sexual scenes and imagery in the book, there are some in the midst of things. They're a little on the chaste side. They imply more than they show. And in my own thought over the years, and I've got a 15-year-old daughter, and my thought really since she hit 7 or 8 was I've kind of reined in things that I might have written or said, because I didn't want her to read them and skew her view of Dad. But also there's a certain pressure there in terms of the people who are around you when you have a daughter that age, the parents of the other kids. You know, they read something right that you might write, and, you know, well, maybe they don't want to send their kid over to your house anymore because, you know, Dad's written about whatever. And I just wondered if you were at all conscious of that, and I guess you kind of answered that.
Well, you know, fortunately, I don't have any plans to write a novel about pedophilia, so I'm sort of safe as far as that goes. But no, I think on some level there is what I do believe is that unless your subject, say, you know, calls for explicit sex or just, you know, gobs of profanity, mm-hmm. I don't have any problem with any of that stuff. But I do think that you broaden your market by not putting stuff in that could be, you know, gratuitously offensive to people. Some things you can't worry about offending people if that's part of the inherent truth of the story. But to offend people sort of egregiously with a parenthetic thing just because you needed a love scene, and I mean there are a million ways to write a love scene, and they don't have to a love scene doesn't have to be a sex scene, you know. So to my mind, I do think that, you know, I have, in fact, it's interesting you should say that because I do recall now, I set out, originally I thought I was going to write this novel with no profanity and no explicit sex or no sex whatsoever. But that's too self-consciously chaste, you know, so I was trying to find a balance.
Well, I thought it was handled well. I mean, you know, you have this couple that comes together and, I mean, they come together, I don't mean they come together, but they have a relationship that kind of blossoms through the course of the action and the story, and I thought it was handled well, and it was handled in a way that, you know, your 10-year-old could read and not be, ooh, Daddy, ick, you know, whatever.
Right, but, that's true. Well, I did write a novel that was serialized called Cadaver Blues that was a mystery, and ironically, it's on the internet. Anybody can find it, and there is a fairly explicit sex scene in that novel, but the novel called for it. And in this case, I think, you know, part of, you know, suspense of any kind, and you can have, you know, sexual suspense, you know, as well as suspense with the threat of violence or whatever it is. Suspense is really about what you leave out, not what you put in. It's about expectation. And to some extent, the second that those guys were, you know, flirting around each other, you know, fall into bed with each other, there's a release of that tension, and it's lost forever. You know, the will they or won't they? Is lost forever. It's also a little bit of a technique to string these things along to give the reader just one more point of tension, one more point of suspense.
So, Joel, let me ask you, what have you learned about being a writer now that you didn't previously know as an editor or an agent?
It's an interesting question. I think that there's a, you know, I've always had people tell me that I was a talented writer, but I had not really sat down and committed myself to it as a, you know, as a course of life. I think, you know, one of the things that inherently when you sit, you know, in the seat of a gatekeeper, whether it's as an editor or an agent, you know that there's a lot of stuff out there, and that you get very impatient with things that are not, you know, executed at a high level, say, whether that's because the person doesn't have the talent or didn't put the effort in or whatever it is. And, you know, I think I've learned that you need to have the highest expectations for yourself, and you can't rush things. Mm-hmm. So you can't, you know, there's a degree to which as a writer, you finish writing something, and immediately you want to show it to somebody. And the mark of professionalism is actually withholding it from other people for a while and trying to make yourself your toughest critic. And, you know, even then, people are going to have feedback that's, you know, that's valuable, but you don't want to show it to people too soon. And I think that's been the hardest thing to remind myself of. It's something I sort of knew from the other side, but there's a lot of hard work that goes into making something, you know, pure polished, and you've got to create distance for yourself. And so you need to be patient before you share it with others. And the other thing is that once you share it with somebody, it's sort of like the horse has left the barn. You're never going to get the same read, even from a professional reader, the second or third time as you got the first time. And it's important to really make that first time count.
I think that's an extraordinary point, and I'm not kidding with you. I really do. I think if the two of us had known that 15 years ago, it would probably have done us both good. It's something I tell people, you know, if someone talks to me about writing or being productive, I say patience is something I've really learned only in the last 5 to 7 years. And it's still a struggle to write something, you're very excited about it, and to hold it back and keep working on it. I always want to say, look what I just did, look at it. And, you know, the reality is you hold it back and you work on it some more and it gets better.
Yeah.
Some people already know that, and, you know, I guess that's
right.
Us guys had to kind of learn that.
Well, some, you know, you're right. I think some of it's temperament, and you have to sometimes fight your own temperament. Charles Bukowski has a great poem called "So You Want to Be a Writer," and one of the things he says is that if you need to show it to your wife or your girlfriend or your mother, you're not ready.
Yeah, that's a good point. and that will be the entirety of your audience at that point too, if that's what you
that's
do.
Right.
So. You know, we're just about to wrap up, but I got to ask you, any regrets about giving up the literary agency? And please, just say yes, even if you have to lie.
Well, you know, I miss the interaction that I used to have with my clients. I really do. Good answer, right? Yeah, but, you know, on another level, I mean, I think it's a really tough road to hoe right now. There have been a lot of changes. You know, as a writer, you hear no a lot. As an agent, you hear it even more frequently, simply because you're having to pitch that much more frequently. And, you know, it's a very tough business, and there are some people very good at it. I was gratified that most of my former clients still, you know, even though essentially I betrayed them by leaving them, you know, most of them still have warm feelings for me, which is pretty neat. Now, if I'd been their agent still for these intervening 15 years, whatever it is, maybe they would hate me at this point. I don't know. But I think that to some degree you can't live life with regret, and you make whatever decision you make and you move on, and you know, and you'd have to accept that that's just part of you know, the growth of your life.
Fair enough. We'll let it go.
But I do miss you, Bob.
Yeah, I know.
I miss our banter.
Yeah, but there was plenty of that. There was plenty of that. Well, folks, listen. You can find J.E. Fishman. I know him as Joel Fishman. Find his first novel, Primacy, in great bookstores everywhere. Or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. Joel, website, Twitter, Facebook, any of that kind of stuff you want to send people to?
I have on Facebook as Joel E. Fishman. I'm on Twitter as J.E. Fishman, the website is verbitrage.com. You can find me there as one of the authors.
Okay. Very cool.
That's where I'm at.
All right. Well, listen, it was great to have a professional
Excuse me. And Google Plus.
You're
I'm
Google
also
Plus.
On Google Plus as J.E. Fishman.
Put Joel in one of your circles. Not
right.
A circle of doom. Put him in one of your good circles. Joel, great to catch up with you professionally, a little personally, on the side there too. And thanks so much for joining us, Mr. Media, today. Good luck with the book.
Likewise, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. For more original interviews, surf over to our main website, MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. And if you've enjoyed today's show, subscribe for free to Mr. Media via email, RSS, or iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. You can also download our new free Mr. Media mobile app in the Android market. And, of course, you can always listen with a piece of string in a tin can in soap opera land. Show your support of Mr. Media by supporting our sponsors, including Audible. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/radio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/radio for your free audiobook. We're also supported by thepartyauthority.us. Call DJ Ira for all your party entertainment needs nationwide at 1-800-DIAL-DJS or visit their website, thepartyauthority.us. If you've got an idea for a guest, a comment on today's show, or would like to advertise on Mr. Media, email me directly at bob@mrmedia.com. You can also call our 24-hour listener line, 727-498-4711. Some messages may be used in an upcoming show, and unless you live next door to Mr. Media, it's probably a toll call. You can also follow Mr. Media on Facebook, Twitter, or our new YouTube video channel. Thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate you sharing a piece of your day with Mr. Media. Thanks for listening.
Hello, this is novelist Michael Connelly, and you're listening to Mr. Media.
Good morning, and welcome to Plus One for DM with my mom and dad, Jennifer Swalbach and Kevin Smith.
Morning.
Good morning.
How you doing, man?
Well, it's Monday morning.
Week three, bitch. It's me, the fat one, and her, the big-eared one, Kevin Smith.
And Jen Schwalbach.
And this is Plus One Per Diem, as the kids said. Hey, man, let's pay some bills. Pay some bills. Pay this man his money. Give me some music, some bill-paying music. MrMedia.com. So much media, so little time. I hear you, brother.
Who keeps track of it all? That would be Mr. Media.
Yeah, man. Can you keep track of Kev being on his radio show and then being on television and then back on the radio show? I was literally listening to the show. There's a great ad for Stitcher in the midst of this ad. I was listening to our show on Stitcher in my car between leaving my show and coming back to my show. So I got to listen. It works flawlessly. I don't know. Anytime I see people bitch on Twitter, like, hey, I can't get... Holy shit, it's fucking flawless. Anyway... MrMedia.com. Now in its fifth year of online radio and TV shows, there are more than 700 celebrity pop culture and Hollywood interviews in the Mr. Media archive of free and premium subscription shows. Mr. Media, a.k.a. journalist Bob Andelman, loves the ladies, attracting everyone from current TV stars such as Jeri Ryan, 7 to 9 on Star Trek, Summer Glau, she was in Firefly, she was in Terminator as well. I think she was the one that gave Muse shit at a Comic-Con. If she's the one that played the space hooker in Firefly, she was at a Comic-Con and Muse was like a huge Firefly fan. He's like, oh, hey, man, it's really high. And she's like, whatever. Gave him the stone cold fucking shoulder. Anyway.
We don't know it's her for sure.
I'm pretty sure it is. All pretty right. much. But Bob, she didn't do that to old Bob Andelman, Mr. Media. She gave him some fucking ear, and you can hear it. Alicia Cuthbert from 24. Yvonne Strahovski from Sarah or Sarah on Chuck. To classic movies stars such as Raquel Welch. He's got all the ladies, man. Jeri Ryan, Summer Glau. Is it Elijah or Alicia Cuthbert? Alicia? Chick from 24.
Mm-hmm.
Yvonne Strahovski. Raquel Welch. There's even a video interview with Jason Mewes, Shoot the Hero co-star Samantha Lockwood. That is a starry, starry list. Lots of comedians drop by to chat on the show, too, including Eddie Griffin, Lisa Lampanelli. She did something very cool this weekend, man. Ralphie May, Judy Tenuta, and the late Bob Schimmel twice. He's a good guy. Did you know him? Good dude. Was he at the club? You've been around.
Yeah, actually, I worked with him at the Improv. He was an amazing, amazing man.
Right on. What did he die? Was cancer or something?
No, actually, he beat cancer. It was a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. He'd actually beaten that. It was a car accident, of all things.
Get out of here, really?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. So you can hear interviews with the late Bob Schimmel, man, from Mr. Media. Mr. Media.
Big bucket of wind.
Big bucket of wind right there. Comic book fans, Mr. Media knows what you want. Search the archives to hear interviews with classic Marvel artists such as Gene Colan. I got a Gene Colan Daredevil piece. And Jolton Joe Sinnott, as well as Dave Gibbons of Watchmen, Darwin Cook, Playboy's Gahan Wilson. I love the art of Gahan Wilson. He did tons of National Lampoon's artwork. Oh, my God, he's good. And underground comics legend Dennis Kitchen. I imagine Kitchen Sink. There are also conversations with the comic strip creators behind Pearls Before Swine, Leo, Zitz, and more. If you're in a podcast, check out Mr. Media's conversations with What the Fuck comedian Mark Maron. Or Emily from Sex with Emily, from the Howard Stern universe, Stuttering John Melendez, Red Peters, Mr. Skin. They've all made appearances. This guy is fucking...
He's got a list.
Yeah, Mr. Media's got a list of guests as big as his dick. New shows are posted several times a week with MrMedia.com. You can also subscribe to Mr. Media for free on iTunes, YouTube, or Stitcher for mobile devices such as iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or the Palm Pre. Visit MrMedia.com to get tons of media for free. Mr.
Good morning. You're listening to Sir Smodcast Internet Radio.